Notebook Hukamnama, number 4, The Red Notebook. In this episode of the Notebook Hukamnama, I'm not randomly selecting a notebook. I am turning to a red paper notebook that I've had on my mind for a few days because I believe I know what's in this. I believe it's when I was living on the sailboat in Sydney. And I believe that this notebook contains a clue to the future direction of Here in Absentia, the trilogy, even possibly to Beef Hampton, the first aspect of the trilogy. You've had enough for now. Talking to the dog. So just before I open this, before I crack this baby open, I'll just remind you that the Hukamnama is what the Sikhs do. It's a Sikh practice of opening their holy book at random and beginning with and then singing the reading and singing the incantations they find therein at random and letting kind of the universe dictate. And that's kind of what I usually do, although lately I've been looking through some notebooks from beginning, but I'm really dying to just open this and to start reading it. What I'm going to do is just in these Notebook Hukamnama episodes, which are kind of the subgenre of solitary confinement in the digital age, if that makes any sense whatsoever, I read from my past notebook scrawlings, and they're always the most enjoyable thing for me. Let's crack this baby open. Well, I'm just going to read this on this side. Wow. Okay. There's an asterisk. And then it begins. Cyclists on the Gulf Islands ferry had to push their bikes to the front of the vehicle level and lean them in this barely barricaded section among various pipes, vents, boilers, and iron compartments with steering wheels for door handles. I never know which crucial piece of equipment I meant to lean my bike against, said the taller, older, impeccably dressed, rather Jewy sort of man. Xander gave a flabbergasted... Xander's the character's name here. Interesting, Xander. Xander gave a flabbergasted laugh as he tried to wedge his bike between a curved pipe and some sort of grated vent on the side of the boat. He stood up and appraised the total ridiculousness of the setting. The place for bikes was totally not intended as a place for bikes when the boat was built. An excellent system, he said. The Jewy man laughed, and both men parted, beaming. And then it says, as a headline, Beer 8. Huh, I'm just reading this. He suspected this might not be Beer 8. When he was fishing through the box to retrieve the 4 beer for his sudden island excursion, there seemed to be a little less in there than his record would attest, but he refused at that point to take the actual inventory. The sudden windfall rendered all that irrelevant. He now sat on a stone shell and sea glass beach with the first beer of the Saturday. Oh yeah. He buys himself. Okay, that's what this is. Oh, here. I'm helping up. I forgot all about this. You ready? You got it. There you go. So that's what I'm reading. Okay, this is not what we think it is. It's not beer. This, if I opened it at random, as I recall, I forgot all about this. I wrote a character, how does it go? 15, a story. Huh. I think I could just take it separately from, it's part of, supposedly at one point it was part of the big three, you're meant to be, but, holy cow. It was called 15 Beer Until Tuesday. And something happens where he's totally poor. He decided he would keep a record of these 15 beer and 4 approximate days and $7 to his name. So that's what it is. He decided he would keep a record of these 15 beer and 4 approximate days and $7 to his name. He had 3 great books on the go. In fact, he had spent part of his last 50 fueling up so he could drive to some far-flung library branch to collect this title. Ah! But how he'd longed for it for months. Marshall McLuhan and Northrop Frye, Apocalypse and Alchemy by B.W. Powell. By far the best McLuhan book in my opinion. It sure was a squalor that he found himself in, this Xander Zalupan, huh? There in the base of the sailboat, bearded, unbathed for days, crumpled clothes everywhere. This will be part of the book. Crumpled clothes everywhere, raving, the clothes and he. And somehow thrown back into the relief and terror of the bad seed, freedom, how soft and how sharp the divide was. The sailboat needed to become a sanctuary, or he was doomed. Was he doomed? He was broke again and had no work till Tuesday, when the good fortune opened its doors again. Wow. 20 consecutive days of no tip money had truly drained him. He had $5 from Suki and about $2.23 of his own personal liquidity. There was that other $1.56 in the bank account of his that was not overdrawn. In the one that was overdrawn, he didn't even want to think. He had to make it to Tuesday when the tips from lunchtime would kick in. He thought he could easily do it. He had some good supplies. Blah, blah, blah. 3 cans of something. 3, some strange sort of instant bag of soup, 2 samosas, 2 crunchy peanut butter, 15 beer, 2 joints, and a bag of experimental brownies. A customer had given him at the marina tonight. Oh, a guest at the marina tonight, and a huge soiree with Greek American. Well, I don't know what the heck. And Xander had walked through it en route. There was that big party. Oh, was that? Anyway, Joyce Pound, Elliot Quixote, Xander's companions of solitary, so beautiful there, huh? By Tuesday, the insides of this sailboat shall resemble the best cells of solitaire. And he decided it was time to crack the first and most compelling of the 3 great titles he was working on. Our Only Hope is Apocalypse. Yep. McLuhan said that, all right. Now we're going to beer 3. After 10 pages of the McLuhan Fry Brook, he had to put it down. It was certainly the most fascinating 10 pages he's read in a while. What a pair these two were. 2 giants of the mind, born within one year of each other, as erudite in literature as anyone can be, and both teaching miles from one another in Toronto. And how his intersection with McLuhan in Toronto had rocked his entire life. McLuhan, some sort of ghost form, had seized him by the throat of the spirit while he had lived there, gloried in this 2-year respite from his glaring unemployability. The ghost of McLuhan had come to him and said, you scion of solitary confinement and the overall ineluctable isolation of nights alone in prison cells with books, you unlikely saint. Where am I going here? Over one page. You unlikely saint. This didn't make sense. You are the only hope we have. You unlikely saint. You are the only hope we had. Who said this? McLuhan said this. Wow, what a title. He knew for certain he was the only. Oh, CF prisoner, Canadian federal prisoner to be released into Moncton, New Brunswick on a day pass, who would ever in the history of prisoners released on day pass stood amazed, totally blitzed, not just by the freedom, but by the fact that he was walking the streets walked by Northrop Frye. On the streets Northrop Frye walked. On one of these days passes, he had to attend a program entitled Community Integration and was overjoyed that the class was to be held in the Northrop Frye room in the Moncton Library. When he got there and saw what a shitty little room it was, he was enraged. They should name the whole bloody library Northrop Frye, he said to some puzzled desk girl at the library entrance. Ah, and McLuhan. He couldn't start thinking about McLuhan. Not yet. McLuhan would come later, later in the beers. At the end of his first beer, he decided he must make a record of his time until Tuesday. These were to be sacred days, though he was to be... He was beginning here in squalor. There was a bearable chill in the gray gloam, and he slid the hatch of Seagrass a little further shut. Ah, Seagrass. He felt a little... I'm sorry I abandoned you. Seagrass. Xander felt a little queasy at the notion that he was filling his body with poison in the form of the poisonous bliss of a drunkard, the knowledge of goodly evil, O sanguine, the poetry. And it was true, though, he had found a strange entelechy through the heavens in the vortex of McLuhan and Fry, for their vortex... Where does this go now? Yeah, I used to write in this really strange way. I forgot. I used to write like, for their vortex was Joyce Pound. I think it goes back up here now. Was Joyce Pound, Eliot, Quixote. That's what it was. The thing I read first, this is an Ouroboros. I used to do that. I used to start on the right-hand side of the page, and if I kept writing, I'd jump back over to the left. Is that how it works here? Our only hope is apocalypse, and then... I think for that was true. Xander had discovered one strange fact through the literature, that there was a great code. There was sanctity. There was God. God is not a concept, but an ever-present fact, was what McLuhan told a bureaucrat within the Catholic Church. As McLuhan politely declined the bureaucrat's request that McLuhan fill out some sort of questionnaire on the nature of God. And boy, oh boy, Xander had swung into it so unexpectedly when he moved to Toronto. It freaked him out, and it still freaks him out, both how completely the McLuhan vortex got him and the totality of what something showed him. And then it says beer 4. I love Glennie, he thought, thinking of his dear cousin in Winnipeg. Aww. Glenn would love to hear this. I love Glennie, he thought, thinking of his dear cousin in Winnipeg. Glennie had developed some sort of heart condition and was told that he would die if he continued drinking. And Glennie continued drinking and was not dead. In Winnipeg now, but he was a Saskatchewan boy, Glennie. His son had come out to the Winnipeg now, but he was a Saskatchewan boy, Glennie. His son had come out to the island in February and delivered the news, and when he heard it, Xander clenched his hand into a fist and pumped it, albeit discreetly. Way to go, Glennie, he said quietly, albeit loud enough so everyone in the room could hear. It was dark outside, the Haida eyes of Seagrass now. The lantern light had given the squalor a much more dignified look, though still the place would look better were it not squalor. Tomorrow is Saturday. Tuesday is a ways away. Yeah, it's 15. He had neglected Seagrass so much, but she really was quite an exquisite little craft. She was a Haida, made in Victoria, the same year he was born. Oh, Seagrass. First put on the water the year his father suicided, in a car, in the family garage in Prince George. Seagrass had this wonderful little toilet that you flush by ramming away at a handle pump. Xander had no idea where it all went, but it went. In the record leading up to Tuesday he was keeping, he wrote down, I've just fallen into the teapot. This was his own personal code word for the fact that he was now high on marijuana, more or less KO'd. But Xander loved these moments on the threshold of the KO. He was a shaman, in a ridiculous sort of way, though he was more an explorer, a flaneur of the strange stream of life his destiny had provided him. Prisons, fights, drunks, literature, great realms of literature that the modest, well-adjusted aspirant could not imagine. Delusions, to be sure, delusions, visions of prescience in, when he was 19, in solitary, in Saskatchewan, the worst possible sort of killer to be in Saskatchewan, a killer of one of the missing and murdered, where a man with first-hand knowledge of the whole monstrosity, the whole hopelessness of knife life as we know it. Our only hope is apocalypse. Beer 5. It was time to talk of the consul. In Malcolm Lowry's novel Under the Volcano, the consul, the greatest alcoholic, the only alcoholic in all of literature to show and exude and involve the grandeur and sad, ennobled mystique of what Fry would probably classify as the Li Po archetype in his constant cataloguing of the great code, the drunken poet, or, if you will, the poet drunkard. At the height of his mescal sanctified drunkenness, the consul, after succeeding in his day's mission to drink his way to La Ferrolito, the lighthouse, El Ferrolito, I guess it should be, is surrounded by corrupt revolutionary thugs who interrogate him, suspecting he is a spy. If he wants to play their game and provide them with legit answers to the questions he is asking, he can. But at this point in his day and in his life, when they demand to know his identity, he decides he doesn't bloody care what happens and makes a spoof of the whole proceedings. He tells them he is William Blackstone, the name of an actual dude who left society in the way back days and went to live among the Indians. The consul is safe inside his brassy, drunken halo. He's feeling robust and cheeky. He knows they're going to kill him if he keeps going along this route. But the route, he suddenly recognizes, is his holy calling. Someone threw a dead pariah dog down after him into the ravine, is how the novel ends. Beer 6. He looked across at the tins of ravioli. He thought about ravioli, the man. He couldn't quite hate the pissant. Ravioli was the real deal. Xander suspected that some problems had occurred when the real deal suddenly realized he was such, but still he knew that some fault did lie in the lecherous poetics. Strange that he had bought those three tins of ravioli at Walmart without once connecting the find at Walmart without once connecting the food to the name to his own rather desperate position. All he had wanted were the three cheapest tins that had the pop can opener contraption on the top, and they all turned out to be some form of ravioli. He remembered that summer ravioli took the job making ramen noodles in the boutique factory. This is all code, by the way. Ravioli is not ravioli. Ravioli is someone else, and he wasn't making ravioli. He wasn't making ramen. He was making ravioli. He said it occurred to himself after playing 2 hours of songs that he had written in Horsefly. He could make $400 in 2 hours in Horsefly or in a week of squeezing ramen noodles through the press with little to do but stare at black girls' hands and buttocks at the station, at the black girls' hands and buttocks at the station in front of him. The nice thing about this sudden rejection from ravioli was his poignancy. It was nice to feel life poignantly again. This must have been just after I fell. The last big poignancy in Toronto, it was truly McLuhan rated, but it was Flannery that stretched it all together. Without Flannery, all those other twinklings from the McLuhan galaxy would have come off as irrelevant. But when you think of the cause and effect of things, it all relates back to the years of solitary. And here, I apologize for digressing. We must talk about Hemingway. True, Crime and Punishment was the first book to really rock Xander into the world of literature. Hemingway was a close second. Hemingway found something in language and also articulated something about life. Hem articulated Van Morrison's Wild Night is Calling, the way Hem described the gay boulevard bodiness of Paris nights in the 20s, the way he said it, the hypnosis, the deletions. Well, Xander became obsessed with both Hem and Fyodor before he had turned 20. Hemingway had actually brought him to McLuhan, and then He lived on Poplar Plains Road in Toronto. Dot, and then the handwriting starts to become legible. Beer 7. But the point is, C, to get absolutely wasted. There is the genteel class who like to... He awoke to a peaceful morning that was at once sunny and misty. The comfort of Seagrass's sleeping quarters always felt like such a blessing, even in his penury, even in his squalor. He untangled himself from his heap of blankets and began folding his clothes and sorting the ones that were really unwearably dirty from those that were not. In a short while, he could see the love seat that his clothes had been obscuring. His head felt better to be in a space that was much cleaner. He counted out enough money from his coins and was quite delighted to see that he had enough in just the coins to pay for a cup of coffee without having to break his five. This very much took care of his morning. The cafe in the hotel lobby had free refills and free Globe and Mails, and it was Saturday, Saturday, just Saturday, Sunday, and Monday to go until work started again. And really, this was the ultimate way to begin a Saturday, was it not? Even if he had $1 million, he'd probably start out just the same way, unlimited coffees and a nice Saturday newspaper. Well, if he had $1 million, he'd probably buy some breakfast too, but still, a pretty good start. And boom, just like that, look at how the technology can change things. At the cafe, he plugged his phone in, and on his phone he found a message pertaining to an old ad he had pasted online trying to sell yet another of his broken dreams, a broken-down soft ice cream machine, a piece of junk. He'd bought it for $800. It worked for 20 days, then stopped working. That was 2 summers ago. He'd had the ad online for months. Then today, amid his first refilled coffee, he received a message from a prospective buyer asking to see the machine immediately. He was torn. They probably wouldn't want it, and if he left the cafe, he might disqualify himself from the free refills. He might have to buy another coffee, and he didn't have enough money to do that. If those people didn't buy it, his whole day would be shot. But if they did... So, he went and filled up his coffee mug, opened his notebook on the table, even left his phone plugged into the wall. All the signs of an active and occupied table. Then he snuck out the side door. Bill's building, where else would he store an old soft ice cream machine, was only a short pedal away, 3 minutes through the laneways. On the way there, he tried to remember how much he had asked for the soft ice cream machine in the ad. It didn't really matter. He knew he would take anything, anything for it. Whatever they offered, even if they offered $5, he would accept. Of course, they might not offer, and he might lose his spot at the cafe, his newspaper, and, if somebody cleared his mug away, his free refills too. What a life is this! They were waiting in the parking lot when he got there, and a plain, plainly built and drably attired woman in her 40s and a lean, sharp-eyed Italian fellow about the same age. The man had gone totally bald on the top of his head, but the top of head was tanned attractively. The rest of his hair fell down to his shoulders in a kind of mullet by default. He had white teeth and a large, strong hands. Up in the suite where the machine was stored, he looked over its guts by the flare of his lighter. Got a leak here, he said. I guess, Xander said. Okay, can we use the elevator to take it downstairs? You want it? Xander said. $100, said the woman. Boy, did they have themselves a deal. What a beautiful, merciful, and sustaining organism was this universe that held him, still alive, alive inside the miracle. How delighted, grateful, relieved he was. How undeserving was he of such mercy, yet perhaps not totally undeserving. Perhaps there was some truth to the notion that he, too, was but a molecule of God, a part of the greater miracle, a part and not a part from it all, a part of and not apart from it all. When he returned to the cafe, his space was still there. His coffee, his newspaper, everything was exactly as he left it, except now he had $5 $20 bills in his pocket. Boom. Hell, he thought. I'm going to have a few more coffees, then I think I'll get myself one of those cranberry yogurt flaxseed muffins. As he pondered his new potentials, he realized there was a way to demonstrate, as it were, the force of an all creation that was indeed grateful, that he was indeed demonstrate to the force of all creation that he was indeed grateful, that though perhaps a selfish and self-involved cretin of a human being on most occasions, he did still have a willingness and a capacity to serve as an instrument of God on some level. Indeed, he had received such grace and mercy with this unexpected $100. It felt like such a blessing. It felt such a blessing to arrive, and he felt some faint sort of drive to ensure that the grace and mercy did not stop with him. The only way to feel God's mercy is to let it pass through you, he reminded himself. Then he paused, sat back, and edited the thought a little. The best way to experience God's mercy is to let it pass through you, and mercy can be interchanged with almost any other word. He remembered the unbroken $5 bill back in the sailboat. When he'd left the boat that morning, that bill had been his lifeline to get to Tuesday. It was irrelevant now. The only reason he had the bill was Suki. God bless her. He'd phoned her last night after realizing that the 15 beer he'd purchased had tax on the price and that he was completely broke. Save the coins. Too proud to ask or beg, he ordered Suki angrily to go get him $5. She had. He picked up the technology and gave her a call. Hanji, Suki-ji, Xander have money for you. What the? Xander have money for Suki. What the? How? Selling machine. Suki come now get money before I spend. $20. Xander have $20 for Suki. Thank you, Suki, for your helping me. So that left him with 80, less the price of the muffin. He wondered, when the call had ended, if he should have just told her he had $10 for her. Xander Zalupan could not believe it. He was on the ferry to Pender Island, and he had woken up that morning determined somehow to eke his way through existence on a mere $5 until Tuesday. And he plugged the technology in. An hour later, a dowdy but smart, plain-looking woman had handed him $100, and without further ado, he was en route to the ferries. Salt Spring Island on his mind, but he did not pedal hard enough to catch the boat he wanted, and after some confused babble with the BC Ferries trainee at the wicket, he found himself with a boarding pass to Pender, good for one human and one bicycle. He'd never been to Pender, new terrain. One of the orange vest guys at the terminal was an AA-er, and he noticed also that a foot passenger bound for the same island was also a member of the distinguished group that he was. He winced a little, remembering the 4 beer lurking inside his backpack, the 4 beer, the half joint, the brownies his accountant had given him. He winced, and then he joyed, for with him he also had McLuhan and Fry's apocalypse book, and he had that other great rare piece of art that he had encountered at a thrift shop in the village, First Love by Ivan Sergeyevich Turgenev. Ah, oh, I lost it on the boat. Such an uncommon Turgenev title, yet on the back someone named Lord David Cecil had declared it one of the few perfect achievements of fiction, and in the introduction convincingly elaborated upon this, and in the first 86 pages, Turgenev has made a strong case for the claim that First Love was indeed one of the few perfect achievements of fiction. All about the tumultuous ferocity of young love, Lord Cecil praised Turgenev's ability to magnify the enchantments and most refined poignancies of life lived raw. Not that Turgenev spends any time on analysis, Cecil says. He just describes a speech or an action and leaves us to interpret the significance ourselves. And he gives the instance of the young 16-year-old hero wildly in love with the seductive 21-year-old Zinaida. The hero is sitting on a 14-foot wall. Zinaida passes underneath. Jump down to the road if you really do love me, she says, jokingly. As if he were pushed from behind, the boy finds himself jumping. As if pushed from behind. The description flashed through Xander's brain as he boarded the ferry. That's how I feel right now. Cyclists on this Gulf Islands ferry had to push their bikes to the front. Okay, so I read that. That's where I started. Had to push their bikes to the front of the vehicle and lean them on the barrel. So the bubble wasn't meant for that. He suspected this might be beer 8. That's right. So because he didn't want to count inventory. He refused at that point to take the actual inventory. The sudden windfall rendered all that irrelevant. That's what it means. Okay. He now sat on a stone shell and sea glass beach with the first beer of the Saturday stashed covertly at his hip, open, half, as it were, full. A man with a thick German or Austrian